Lewis Perry comes to us from a distinguished career as a leading American history scholar. You have read his list of publications in the printed program, which establish him as an authority on the abolition movement in America. A more impressive point to me, a European historian, is that he's the editor of the Journal of American History. That not only means that he lives in Bloomington, Indiana, and listens to all the wonderful music congregated there, but he has his finger on the heartbeat of research in American history, because his journal is the premier scholarly journal in the field. He would not have been selected to edit the JAH if he had not also been one of the premier minds among American historians. As editor, he has to know what is happening in the scholarly activity of the whole field. He's going to talk to us about the word intellectual. As you know from personal experience in our culture, it's a loaded word. Many Latter-day Saints feel the word refers to someone who is snooty, condescending, and suspect. The feeling is so widespread, not only among Mormons, but among Americans in general, that some people who engage in intellectual pursuits hesitate to use the word in reference to themselves. Nonetheless, it is an honorable word. To me, the word intellectual refers to a person who thinks tentatively about serious matters. Hence, that person tries to suspend dogma, even commitment, for a while as he or she considers many dimensions of an issue objectively. Thereafter, the person may return to commitment, reinforced and comfortable, or he may be disturbed, even threatened. Intellectuals see this as high adventure and fundamentally constructive. Not all observers agree with them. This can cause a gulf between intellectuals and their contemporaries, and this often occurs between intellectuals and laymen who think about religion. Mr. Perry is an intellectual and a longtime participant in a religious congregation, has chosen to address this specific situation. His book, Intellectual Life in America, brought him head-on to this problem. Certainly, that makes him a welcome guest in Salt Lake City, the capital of Mormondom, because we can proudly report that there has been intellectual ferment in Mormon country, at least since Vaughn McKay Brody published her controversial book on Joseph Smith in 1945, and increasingly since Leonard Arrington ushered in a new vitality in Mormon studies in 1958 with his Great Basin Kingdom. Since then, the cauldron has been bubbling with increased intensity, spewing forth substantial books, new journals, scholarly articles, newly discovered documents, and resulting debates in every direction. All this has been both reinforcing and discomforting, and not without considerable reaction from laymen and ecclesiastical leaders. Lewis Perry is here to help us place this adventure in a larger context and to learn from the history of intellectual life in America. He will particularly focus his remarks toward the non-academic people who are watching with excitement, even producing some of it. We therefore welcome Lewis Perry to the Crossroads of the West.
I'm indeed honored at the invitation to speak with you on this occasion. I've had wonderful hosts to introduce me to Salt Lake City, where I had never visited before. I've attended several sessions and found food for thought that will sustain me for some time to come. I've heard accounts of intellectual careers quite different from the patterns that I'll shortly describe. I've also heard accounts very close to my scenario. I have resisted the temptation to try to retailor my remarks to what I have learned here. Maybe there'll be another time for that. But in my own mind, I have benefited from the kind of give and take, the challenge of new possibilities, the confirmation of new information that makes intellectual life at its peak so exhilarating and worthwhile. So I'm really very pleased and honored to be here. I shall begin and end with brief stories about generations. These stories may put the central section of my talk, which is what I have to offer as a scholar, in a more personal, intellectual context. Thus, the talk is segmented, just as my theme is segmentation. My 18-year-old son, about to start college, thinks my title, Falling Apart, Turning Inward, is amusing, and he offered with great hilarity some suggestions for opening this talk by demonstrating how intellectuals could fall apart and turn inward at the same time, a kind of simultaneous explosion and implosion. Having lived with an intellectual for a good many years, he wouldn't be surprised to see them moving with great intensity in two directions at once. He recently himself gave an earnest and, to me, deeply moving high school graduation speech on the meaning of being an intellectual. From this speech, I know of his commitment to intellectual inquiry, a commitment that separates him, as he explained it, from the routine preoccupations of being a teenager. He was surprised, however, when 5 years ago, after a long period of studying religious movements as a fairly dispassionate outsider, I returned to the small denomination in which I was brought up, Universalism, now merged with Unitarianism, and became a Sunday school teacher and, in general, a very active member of my local congregation. My son's hilarity about my title does not alienate me from him. My renewed religious affiliation gives me a sense of connection with my parents and grandparents. As a scholar, I still feel obliged to consider all religions with equal objectivity. I do see the humor in the title, as I said, and I do not mean to depict impossible scenes of physical contortion as some intellectual version of Plastic Man. Perhaps I should have chosen an earlier title that I toyed with, Fragments and Compartments. In any case, I wish to focus attention on the lack of an integral culture to give coherence to the endeavors of intellectuals as a group in America, and also on the tendency of intellectuals to develop a high-priced give-and-take within subcultures of their own making. Separated from the American people, divided among themselves, intellectuals point up some of the problems of religion in America. We live in what one scholar has called a segmented society. Probably it does not feel that way to most of us all of the time. In our families, churches, professional groups, we surround ourselves with like-minded individuals. And when our national leaders speak of a common American mission, we tend to think of a unified nation made up happily of people just like us. Sometimes our leaders speak of a common religion, as when most recently Ronald Reagan declared 1983 the year of the Bible, or when Secretary of the Interior Watt spoke of America as God's chosen place. But there are moments, perhaps when we watch television or go to the movies, perhaps when we travel, when we discover that we are not just like other Americans. Some of us need only to go from work to home or to the supermarket to feel we are passing from one realm to another. As a historian, I appreciate the importance of a Bible culture in America, and I do not underestimate the necessity for national leaders to articulate shared beliefs and goals. But I would be false to my profession if I ignored the diversity of the people of this marvelous, complicated nation. What do Watts and Reagan's proclamations, or those of previous administrations, mean, I wonder, to the Jews in America, to Muslims, to the increasing numbers of Asians with different religions? Does it mean the same thing to Polish Catholics, as to West Virginia snake handlers, to Christians who pursue different understandings of the Scripture, to those who follow other revelations and sacred texts besides the Old and New Testament? I'm sure those proclamations, in any case, were puzzling, they were probably meant to be irritating, to a great number of intellectuals who have become one of the most segmented and secularized groups of Americans. I don't need to take much time to show that intellectuals frequently assume that America has become secularized, or at least that their America, that part of it in which they spend their time as intellectuals, has come to differ from old-time visions of a unified Protestant nation. It would be hard to find many works in the mainstream of humanistic, social scientific, or scientific fields in which God or the Bible are important explanatory concepts. In a field where I have done a great deal of work, the study of 19th century American reform movements, textbooks sometimes warn students that abolitionists and other reformers, and I'm quoting from one of them, were devout Protestants whose public expressions of piety have appeared sanctimonious to an age that has equated social progress with secular rational thought. As editor of a journal, I recently received an article on the emergence of agnosticism in the late 19th century, One of the readers, who was asked to evaluate the article, commented that it described a situation much like he worked at a prestigious university. I mention these examples simply to indicate that intellectuals may take it for granted that their discourse, if not anti-religious, exists outside the realm of religion. Discourse is, in fact, a key word in that branch of history that specializes in the study of intellectuals. Usually, it is pointed out that intellectual discourse is distinguished by the ideas, terms, and values current within small groups writing for and speaking to one another. We no longer feel comfortable taking writers and thinkers, however ingenious or inspirational, as representative of larger demographic or political entities. What matters is what intellectuals were saying within the context of their own circles. While much illuminating history is being written from this perspective, it seems likely to me that intellectual historians are reading back into the past a segmented cultural condition that threatens them or maybe accomplishes them in the present. It is the emergence of that state of affairs that I wish to explore this evening. How did intellectuals come to feel confined in small circles of discourse, cut off, except perhaps in their private lives, from any common faith? It could be said, of course, that such a state of affairs reflects inevitable antagonism between religion and intellectual inquiry. As early as 1716, the Puritan divine Cotton Mather resented the introduction of moral philosophy as a separate field of scholarship at Harvard. Morals, the province of religion, should not, he felt, be turned into an independent field of study. By the late 19th century, several well-known books spoke of persistent warfare between religion and science. To some observers, another field of inquiry was perceived as threatening because it removed subject matter from controlling interpretation of religion. Since then, since the late 19th century, many writers have explained, proudly or with dismay, that there has been, and I'm quoting a writer in 1928, a reduction of the number of thoughts and deeds which display themselves under the religious guise. But this view of inevitable antagonism between religion and intellectual life will not stand examination. Regardless of Mather's ire, most moral philosophers regarded their work as basically religious. They were uncovering laws of human nature that were part of God's contrivance of the universe. Similarly, recent scholars have shown that there was surprisingly little antagonism between religion and science in Darwin's era in America. In many different ways, scientists and theologians interpreted their work as mutually reinforcing. Science and religion were flexible enough concepts that intellectuals could continue to see themselves as science-oriented and as spokesmen for a Protestant vision. Throughout the 19th century, moreover, intellectuals were generally able to see themselves as in touch with the people. One example was the great historian George Bancroft, who was also a leader of the Democratic Party, even serving in Polk's cabinet. Bancroft maintained that in all human history, there was no great discovery of truth which did not equally have its source in the mind of everyone. All useful innovations in thought, he said, were applauded by popular judgment. There was no room in Bancroft's philosophy for such modern terms as segmentation or alienation. Numerous other, less extreme examples could be found of writers and thinkers who took it for granted that their position was that of a Christian notable, speaking from within common bonds of feeling with their countrymen. When did that feeling of solidarity and public respect begin to shatter? It would be a mistake to focus too narrowly, I think, on one date. Throughout much of modern history, feelings of disintegration and introversion, falling apart and turning inward, have crept into some spheres of intellectual life. Normally, we think in terms of the 20th century, perhaps the 1920s, but in writing a book on Henry Clark Wright, a mid-19th century reformer, it became clear to me that for some men and women, the strains were felt a century earlier. Wright was regarded by many contemporaries as a radical and extremist, but he had a knack for anticipating positions that others adopted shortly afterward. He was an abolitionist, feminist, pacifist, health reformer, spiritualist, and what made him most controversial of all, a critic of the Bible and institutional religion. He began his career in the 1820s, as an alumnus of Andover Seminary and an Orthodox congregational minister in Essex County, Massachusetts, as a man who prided himself in fitting into an evangelical United Front. Yet by the 1840s and 1850s, he toured the Northeast and the Midwest as a kind of vanguard speaker on the theme that I would call modernity. A good number of other lecturers and speakers pointed in the same direction. What were some of the signs of modernity? Foremost was the view that the conscientious thinker was adrift in an unmoored intellectual world, compelled to work out his own meanings for experience in the absence of fixed, reliable authorities. Though he cherished the motto, "Alone with God," to convey his sense of being watched by a higher power, despite his shifting opinions, he also proposed that change, revolution, was the best watchword for the era. Bancroft, in fact, also hymned the advantages of eternal motion with nothing fixed but the certainty of change. A second element of modernity was an increasingly introspective, inward-turning attitude that in Wright's case led me to call him a precursor of Freudian psychoanalysis. Besides his keen interest in physical health, manifested in books on diet, the water cure, temperance, and pregnancy, he was an incurable dissector of mental states, of memories from childhood, of voices calling out from within his consciousness. Ralph Waldo Emerson described the entire post-revolutionary generation as born with knives in their brains, a tendency to introversion, self-dissection, anatomizing of motives. A recent, highly acclaimed book on the anti-slavery movement, Lawrence Friedman's Gregory of Saints, stresses the segmentation of Wright's allies into intimacy circles and little sanctuaries of friendship with their own intense inner dynamics. In the South, some pro-slavery spokesmen felt that as intellectuals, they were doomed to live in a little sacred circle, always out of touch with their countrymen, a necessary but brooding and dishonored element in society. One source of the pattern that I'm calling modernity was the perception that authority wasn't very clear in the first place. Joseph Smith, who grew up in upstate New York at roughly the same time as Wright, recalled, "So great were the confusion and strife among the different denominations that it was impossible for a person young as I was and so unacquainted with men and things to come to any certain conclusion who was right and who was wrong." Wright, Henry Clark Wright, was not troubled until he went to Andover Seminary as a devout rural young man and tried to make sense of orthodoxy amid sectarian competition, to find a common ground of agreement between Calvinist and revivalist views of God and salvation. Andover, where he went, sought to match Harvard's training in advanced methods of scholarly interpretation, especially in biblical studies, without submerging students in universal skepticism. Wright learned to study the Bible and ancient languages, the same book that his father had read in English at the daily family gatherings. He had his proofs of God's existence chopped apart by a logical professor who did not, to Wright's taste, supply a convincing alternative. Like many seminarians, he passed through a distressing crisis of faith that led him to locate the only certainty, religious or otherwise, in his own consciousness. I don't think Wright's experience would have differed greatly if he had trained elsewhere, and Harvard also demonstrated in the well-known instance of the Transcendentalists the difficulty of drawing lines of authority while encouraging new methods of inquiry. A second source of the patterns of modernity was the reorganization of professions in Wright's early 19th century America. The ministry in some regions was in the process of transformation from a local office in which ministers served long tenures among the people of a single locality to a far-flung profession in which ministers moved from one spot to another in the course of what they were apt to consider an individual career. Eventually, some critics complained that ministers were too little concerned with local pastoral responsibilities, too preoccupied with aspects of their profession that could advance their careers. Men like Wright saw themselves less and less as figures in a local hierarchy, more and more as members of a professional stratum of ministers. They were bound to be introspective about their own personalities as they sought to explain their successes and their failures. Wright, like many other Andover Seminary students of his time, eventually left the ministry altogether, and he conceived himself a roving reformer intellectual. Like most biographers, I'm tempted to go on about Wright and his time at greater length. But I'll resist. Clearly, he lived in an era when the dangers of a culture falling apart and of segmented groups turning inward could be felt very powerfully. In the latter half of the century, these strains in some ways may have become more intense and may have seemed more intense. At least many students of intellectual life in the late 19th century have noticed a crisis of faith. Even some religious leaders considered doubt to be a normal occurrence, a fact of life to be overcome, as Wright had earlier discovered, by recognizing an inescapable belief in a higher power that human consciousness could not repress. But it may be an exaggeration to speak of a crisis of faith in that period. Anxiety over the exact place of religion in civilization was offset by growing confidence in the value of culture and the role of the educated classes in achieving human progress. Within the educated classes, there were many divisions. Specialization and professionalization were hallmarks of university training and economic organization. Within individual professions, there might be little talk of religion. There were methods of study and bodies of information to master. But I don't think we can understand 20th century intellectual patterns without acknowledging the pervasive celebration of culture of a generation or so before. This celebration gave members of the educated professions, as they were called, a common sense of purpose. They were able to speak of ideal ends toward which society was progressing, and to speak with vague but undeniable of a divine scheme that unified their endeavors. Despite the contrast between economic classes and ethnic groups, despite vast changes in industrial organization and steady advances in human knowledge, there remained, in the words of the scientist president of one great state university, a dimly seen something toward which we stretch forward our hands. Intellectuals may not have been representative of all Americans, but they were mediaries, or they felt that they were mediaries, between Americans and their higher aspirations. This may have been the age when the themes of falling apart, turning inward, would have seemed least distressing if they had somehow been explained to contemporary intellectuals. Yet I mention this celebration of culture because in the 1910s and 1920s, it was repudiated by many of those who call themselves intellectuals. Culture may even be said to have disintegrated. And in that disintegration, we see once again the outline of our modern situation. I can enumerate several ways in which it fell apart. First, there had been dissident voices who called the genteel culture of the late 19th century a pretentious sham. In the 20th century, some of those voices, George Santayana's, Walt Whitman, Mark Twain, Thorstein Veblen, and so on, some of those voices seemed increasingly persuasive. Second, there emerged a major new assault from anthropology. Starting from Franz Boas's work on the relativity of any culture's value to the people to whose experience it responded, proceeding to the highly publicized work of Edward Stauffer, Margaret Mead, Ruth Benedict, all anthropologists who were well-known in popular magazines, work which claimed that the culture of America itself was spurious and unfulfilling compared to those of Indians and Pacific Islanders. Third, the publishing houses of New York City and the avant-garde lifestyles of Greenwich Village attracted several generations of freelance intellectuals who portrayed their lives as great hegiras away from the religious provincialism of small-town America. Anyone who has read such artful autobiographies as Frederick Howe's Confessions of a Reformer or Malcolm Cowley's Exile's Return, and there are others, will recall the feelings of being uprooted, of being torn away or traveling away from the culture of one's childhood that these writers saw as central to their admirable careers. We may also recall that The New Yorker was designed not to appeal to the lady from Dubuque, and that Our Town, though sentimentalized in countless village productions, explored the tensions resulting from the repressive, illusory qualities of non-urban America. Fourth, there was great expansion in the number of those who thought of themselves as social scientists or government service intellectuals. Generally speaking, these men and women sought to apply expert intelligence to social problems while keeping their private views and values to themselves. They could study culture as researchers, but not celebrate it as apostles or enthusiasts. For the first time, then, in the 1920s and 1930s, significant groups of Americans actually called themselves intellectuals. Many of them subscribed to a new ideal, which might be called cosmopolitanism. They regarded intellectuals themselves as a special group who had transcended their parochial, ethnic, and religious backgrounds and joined in honoring superior standards of truth and beauty. Before World War I, some had praised the universities as institutions that brought young Protestant Americans into contact with Jews and foreign-born young men and women, with a resulting liberation from narrow cultural perspectives in which they had been brought up. Before long, particularly in New York, there was a feeling that the literary and political life of young intellectuals pointed to a cosmopolitan future in which the best of all cultural and religious viewpoints would be fused and the rest would lapse into oblivion. The great diaspora of intellectuals from fascist Europe gave rise to deep feelings of pride in an American intellectual life in which ethnic and national origins were irrelevant. In some ways, intellectuals were out of touch with the people. Immigration barriers were going up, not falling down, even while intellectuals praised urban cosmopolitanism. As I have indicated, many of them were keenly aware of the distance they had traveled from the beliefs of their childhood. But there were various compensations that kept this estrangement from causing much anxiety. Public belief in the utility of some kinds of intellectual endeavor, enormous excitement over international movements in science and literature, the interest in the people as objects of documentary expression that the New Deal and the left liberal popular front seemed to cultivate. Cosmopolitanism was a powerful and exhilarating self-description for urban and university intellectuals. To some extent, it remains to this day an important ideal, setting the terms on which intellectuals of different faiths and backgrounds can collaborate. Perhaps I should end my talk right there. One thing that seemed to disappear from intellectual life was religion. If we examine the experience of intellectuals between the world wars, the irrelevance of Christianity and Judaism often strikes us as remarkable. They had broken from the 19th century pattern of intellectual leaders speaking from within evangelical faith. When they thought about religion at all, it was frequently as something remote, obsolescent. Although Prohibition endured throughout the 1920s as the great crusade of much of Protestantism against modern iniquity, intellectuals generally paid it little heed. They were caught by surprise when several states passed laws against teaching the theory of evolution in public schools. They thought that controversy over Darwinism had long since subsided, and suddenly anti-evolutionism emerged as a repudiation of all the evils of urban intellectual life. The conflict drew national attention in the famous 1925 monkey trial of the schoolteacher John P. Scopes in Dayton, Tennessee. Though Scopes lost the trial, the intellectuals succeeded, to their own satisfaction, in turning his antagonist into laughing stock. The popular religion of America was more than ever outside the circles of literature and science. It was belittled by H.L. Mencken and Sinclair Lewis. It was left behind in the small towns from which intellectuals had departed. Those who tried to find commitment in Christian faith, like the poets T.S. Eliot and Alan Pate, frequently chose Episcopalianism or Catholicism, and they did so as a deliberate gesture of stepping outside the realm of their intellectual confreres. They understood that the prevailing temper of intellectual life was cosmopolitan and irreligious. It was more concerned with new mysteries explored by Freud than with the traditional mysteries of the church. In regarding religion as alien to their endeavors, intellectuals failed to perceive dynamic events within American Protestantism. They ignored new movements concerned with personal holiness and the millennial dispensation that united American sects with missions around the world. They were largely unaware of doctrinal movements within evangelical seminaries, the movements which George Marsden has done so much to elucidate, the movements known as fundamentalism. When they were aware of them, they caricatured and misunderstood what was going on. Certainly they were in no position to aid the liberal and modernist elements in the seminaries, who had always looked most favorably on the interests of intellectuals. They had cut themselves off from the religious strivings of most Americans and made the distance between intellectual life and religion a self-fulfilling prophecy. The cosmopolitan ideal remains important, though it has been criticized and attacked many times in the past 40 years. It has helped to make intellectual life more accessible to talented persons, regardless of gender and of different racial, religious, and regional backgrounds, more accessible than ever before in our history. It has supported a commitment to the highest possible international standards of excellence. It is seldom upheld, however, with the defiance, which now sometimes looks narrow-minded, of its devotees between the world wars. In my opinion, it persists not because it is fully satisfactory, but in the absence of anything better to replace it. It is not all-embracing. It is not the direction of a better future which intellectuals are leading the way towards. It is merely one of the compartments into which intellectuals organize their lives, and that makes possible that openness and that commitment to excellent standards that seems to me important. The cosmopolitan ideal began to lose its militance and lower its expectations in the late 1930s. There were many expressions of anxiety about the absence of fixed values in a world of relativity and uncertainty, about the absence of spiritual commitment to keep governments from inhumanity and to lift individuals above selfish materialism. The rise of totalitarianism in Europe deepened misgivings about a completely secular approach to social problems. Former radicals concluded that the acids of modernity, in Walter Lippmann's famous phrase, had dissolved ethical restraints and paved the way for Hitler and Stalin. Lippmann himself considered a conversion to Catholicism. Catholics entered intellectual debate with unprecedented vigor, making similar points about the pitfalls of irreligious ideology. Protestant leaders joined in reasserting the importance of religion, though not always any particular religion, in securing human values. The 1940s and 1950s seemed to offer even greater promise of reuniting intellectual life with religion. War and Holocaust raised questions about the human capacity for evil that secular philosophy seemed ill-equipped to answer. Anti-communism raised fascinating contrasts between gods that failed and gods that were. A popular turn towards religion led many to believe in the imminence of a massive revival. President Eisenhower addressed the American Legion on the theme "Back to God." Most important for our purposes, a number of brilliant scholars turned to the study of religion in a fashion that commanded attention well outside the theological schools and denominational colleges. Paul Tillich, Reinhold Niebuhr, counted among the most admired intellectuals in America. Others, like Will Herbert in sociology, Harry Miller in history, transformed the study of religion in their field from dismissive reductionism to respectful inquiry. Language borrowed from these scholars and from Christian existentialism generally found its way into the discourse of many other fields. Words like irony, ambiguity, insecurity, crisis gained intellectual currency in writings on literature, politics, the American character, and many other subjects. Much as I admire these writers who made the study of religion intellectually respectable in a way that hadn't seemed in much of intellectual life in the 20s and early 30s, I question the depth or permanence of their religious influence on intellectuals. Their favorite terms all could be adopted by secular-minded intellectuals. That was often part of their appeal. And when those terms started to sound passé, they were replaced by others like identity crisis or midlife crisis. Religious studies replaced religion in many college curricula. Changing fads and best-selling titles prompted one student of American religion to call ours the bandwagon era of theological thinking. What seemed constant were the inward-turning, fragmented lives of intellectuals who were no more in touch with the religions of masses of Americans than before. In the 1970s and 1980s, evangelical attacks on secular humanism reminded intellectuals of their estrangement from some forms of popular religion and probably reinforced them in it in a manner reminiscent of the 1920s. There were other shocks to the cosmopolitan idea. Within the universities, the 1960s undermined the intellectuals' image of themselves as an elite vanguard who had placed parochial concerns behind them. Even when repudiating the genteel culture of the late 19th century, intellectuals had still searched for authentic standards, linking together the best that could be derived from all traditions. This search was attacked first by radicals who called it elitism, and later by professionally oriented students who called it irrelevant to their search for jobs. Outside the universities, a series of movements, from black power to the unmeltable ethnics to the roots phenomenon, assailed the cosmopolitan ideal as an illusion that deprived minority groups of their identities. Segmentation went from being a condition to be overcome to being a desirable condition to be upheld and strengthened, at least in these movements that criticized the cosmopolitan ideal. Thus, to the forces drawing intellectuals to pay more attention to religion were added others, insisting that they respect differences in ethnicity, gender, and many other things, and even sexual preferences. As I have said, despite all of these shocks, attacks, criticisms, cosmopolitanism survived as one compartment in the lives of intellectuals. We live at a kind of crossroads when it is difficult to generalize about intellectual life, impossible to forecast its future. But it may be helpful to think of intellectuals as living segmented lives. The assumptions of their professional subcommunities are secular and cosmopolitan. These are realms where there are no Catholics, Protestants, or Jews, only disinterested researchers and specialists who could move from one part of the nation to another without substantially changing their practice. In the institutions that employ them, they recognize different assumptions, more vocational and materialistic, adapting to students and other audiences, often as consumers in a marketplace. And in religion, though I have only some personal impressions and no statistics to prove it, I see evidence that some, perhaps many, are increasingly comfortable with the religions in which they were brought up or with the closest approximation in which they feel welcome. Some don't take that direction. Some never left in the first place. But many of my acquaintances, especially those who are concerned about their children, are going through a process something like that which is called in Judaism a Baal Teshuvah, a return to orthodoxy. Maybe that's too strong a term. It's not an orthodoxy that fills all the segments of their lives. It's not an orthodoxy based on intricate categories like those of Tillich or Niebuhr. There is no hope of a religion that would unite all intellectuals with each other or with the people in general. There is no way of erasing the distance between this generation of intellectuals and their ancestors of different faiths. A friend illuminated this process for me by quoting a story told in Jewish mysticism. This is my concluding story, and it concerns the differences between generations and their relations to truth and authority. I think it is appropriate, in concluding a talk about segmented and introverted tendencies in intellectual life. It has been retold a number of times recently, evidence that others find that the story speaks to their condition. Here it is, without further comment, as recounted by the great scholar Gershom Scholem. When the Baal Shem had a difficult task before him, he would go to a certain place in the woods, light a fire, and meditate in prayer. And what he had set out to perform was done. When a generation later, the Magid of Meseritz was faced with the same task, he would go to the same place in the woods and say, "We can no longer light the fire, but we can still speak the prayers." And what he wanted done became reality. Again, a generation later, Rabbi Moshe Leib of Sasso had to perform this task. And he too went into the woods and said, "We can no longer light a fire, nor do we know the secret meditation belonging to the prayer, but we do know the place in the woods to which it all belongs, and that must be sufficient." And sufficient it was. But when another generation had passed, and Rabbi Israel of Rishon was called upon to perform the task, he sat down on his golden chair in his castle and said, "We cannot light the fire, we cannot speak the prayers, we do not, but we can tell the story of how it was done.
And the storyteller adds, the story which he told had the same effect as the actions of the other three.